Thank you all for coming out on this evening quite close to the holidays. And so my name's Patrick Emerton. I'm an associate in the Katzen Centre for Human Rights Law and also a member of the Legal Theory Group in the Faculty of Law at Monash University. And our guest this evening is in the faculty at the invitation of both the Katzen Centre for Human Rights Law and the Legal Theory Group, because she's a philosopher from the Warwick University Faculty of Law who works on human rights theory. Before I properly introduce Kimberly, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose lands we meet, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And I also told that I'm to announce that this event will be being tweeted by the Katzen Centre, and you can follow on Twitter and join in the conversation, and the hashtag is there on the projections, and also the login and password details are there on the projections for those who do want to follow along. So, as I said, Kimberly Brownlee is a visitor to the faculty and the centre from Warwick University in the UK, and this is part of an ongoing and deepening alliance between the two universities, Monash and Warwick. So she's in the law faculty, but she's a philosopher, a human rights theorist, and her most recent book came out with OUP in 2012 called Conscience and Conviction on Issues in Conscientious Objection. And Kimberly now is working on another book on the human right to sociality and the human right against social deprivation, and it's on that topic that she's going to address us this evening. And so Kimberly will talk for a little over half an hour, and that will then give us 15 to 20 minutes for questions and conversation. So thank you very much, and thank you, Kimberly.
Well, thank you, Patrick, for introducing me, and thank you to the Katzen Centre for the invitation. It's very nice to be back in Australia. I was here 15 years ago, and Sydney was getting ready for the Olympics, and not only was Sydney under construction, all of Australia seemed to be under construction. So the scaffolding everywhere, so it's nice to come back, and everything was unveiled and looking beautiful. So my subject for this evening is being social. I want to talk about the most social of beings, we human beings, and I want to talk about our rights as social beings. And I'd like to begin with a quotation and a story. The quotation's from Aristotle. Aristotle says, "Without friends, no one would choose to live, though he had all other goods." And the story comes from Shane Bauer, who is an American journalist and who was at one point a political prisoner in Iran. And since his release and his return to the States, Shane Bauer has been writing about the experience of solitary confinement. And he toured the California Pelican Bay State Prison and visited their maximum security wing where people were being held in solitary confinement. And his guide asked him whether the experiences that he endured in Iran were different from the conditions he was now viewing in California. And Shane Bauer reports that he mused to himself, "What would my guide say if I told him I needed human contact so badly that I woke each morning hoping to be interrogated? Would he believe that I once yearned to be sat down in a soundproof room, blindfolded and questioned just so I could talk to someone?" Now, in my view, Shane Bauer and the prisoners in the California Bay, Pelican Bay maximum security wing, they endured social deprivation. And by social deprivation, I mean a persisting lack of minimally adequate access to decent social contact. So in solitary confinement in prison, people are forcibly denied access to society. It's a coercive form of social deprivation. And you know, different countries use it more or less extensively. The United States is the worst offender in Western countries, and the numbers vary with respect to how many people are being held in solitary confinement. Some figures are 20,000 people, other figures are 100,000 people. There was an Amnesty International report on California that came out saying that about 3,000 people are being held in really complete isolation, no natural light, no natural programs, and sometimes for many, many years are in suffering in these conditions. There are other institutional settings in which coercive social deprivation is used. In medicine, if someone's being held in medical quarantine for an extended period. In immigration detention, if people are being held in isolation. In the United States right now, there are about 300 people, and that's 1% of the detainees in the 50 largest facilities who are presently being held in isolation, 23 hours a day. And these are people who, for the most part, pose no security risk. So that's probably the clearest case of social deprivation. It's coercive, the person is detained, they're abjectly dependent on other people to come to them and provide social connections. There's a second context in which social deprivation is coercive, but it's not isolating, and that's when your social environment is very brutal. So in a prison setting, in many prison settings, people are not lacking social contact, but they're lacking decent social contact. They're lacking access to decent opportunities for ordinary, decent human connections. A third type of social deprivation is not coercive, it's incidental, or sometimes even accidental. So someone who is elderly or someone with disabilities who is unable to seek out society without assistance, they will be socially deprived. They will lack minimally adequate chances for social connection unless there are some other people willing to associate with them or there's some social structure that would provide it. Now, my aim tonight is to consider what it means to be social, and my more particular aim is to argue that we have a human right against social deprivation. Now, this is not a right that you will find on the books. This is not enumerated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is a neglected one. And indeed, the term social deprivation, to the extent it's used at all, it's often, you know, where it's used, understood to mean economic deprivation. And so I'm not using it for that purpose. I'm talking about our social, interpersonal rights. Now, the economic rights, they have actually received quite a lot of attention recently. There's a lot of debate about the right to be free from poverty, right to shelter, right to food, right to education, right to health care. And much of that debate has assumed that if we take care of those rights, then our social needs will be taken care of as well. So the package of socioeconomic human rights tends to say, let's start with the economic welfare issues and the rest will follow. And I think that's mistaken, because economic conditions, you know, if you improve them, they don't necessarily translate into an improvement in protection of social rights. In our affluent Western societies, there are many people who are isolated, and perhaps actually that's a derivative effect of prosperity, that we have more isolated people. Now, the kernel of my argument for the human right against social deprivation is that we have a right to the conditions that are necessary to lead a minimally decent human life, and having minimally adequate access to social contact is such a condition. And indeed, it's not just a condition, a precondition, it's a constitutive part of a minimally decent human life that we be socially connected. Now, there are three things we can say in support of this idea. The first is a statement about who we are as a species. To be a human being is to be a social creature. We are, as zoologists and psychologists would put it, we are obligatorily gregarious. We must be in the contact of other people. We have the longest period of abject dependency of any species, from babyhood through childhood through, the 30-year-old still living in the parent's basement. We are very much dependent on others for our survival and our prosperity. We also spend about 80% of our waking hours in the company of other people. And according to psychologists, we tend to prefer that time to the time we spend alone. So we have very fundamental social needs. It's part of being human. So that's the first point. The second point is about respect and autonomy. A lot of Western philosophy and a lot of liberal thinking emphasizes autonomy, that as individuals we are autonomous, we can make important choices about how to lead our lives. What often goes neglected is that much of the meaning in our choices comes from our connections with other people. Our employment choices, our life choices, our partnerships, our decisions about reproduction, these are all intersubjective social choices. So respecting us as autonomous means respecting the essential sociality of our decisions. There's a second part to that, and that is recognizing that not only do we need access to other people, but we very much want to make a social contribution. Being human is to desire very deeply to offer our company, to offer our care to other people, and to have that offer be accepted. We want to be dependable. We want to be depended upon to contribute socially. And so when we are deprived of social connections, we don't have those opportunities to offer our social goods to other people. So that's the second point, respect and autonomy. The third point is empirical, and here I step outside philosophy and look to neurology and psychology and take what they say at face value. And there the evidence is pretty clear that we tend to break down when we are denied minimally adequate access to social contact. Neurological studies link chronic loneliness with a whole host of health risks. Psychologists align our experience of loneliness with our experience of pain and thirst and hunger and fear. These are the kinds of experiences that stimulate the fight or flight response. Anxiety-inducing physiological responses that have very negative effects on our brain and our body. And just some of the things that they list off, the neurologists and psychologists, are increased blood pressure, reduced immunity, progression of Alzheimer's disease, early death in older people, reduction of capacity for independent living, suicidal behavior. These are the things that tend to go with chronic loneliness, chronic isolation. And then if you put someone in a more extreme environment of coercive social deprivation, isolation in prison or in medical quarantine, things are even more striking. People tend to hallucinate, to self-mutilate. They become psychotic and also suicidal. And then the anecdotal evidence supports the scientific evidence. So people like Shane Bauer, who have reported on their experiences, say that they not only feel depressed and despondent, but eventually begin to feel mindless. They can't remember facts and figures. They sleep most of the time. Their mind's gone blank. So there's quite striking empirical evidence to suggest this kind of experience is one we should take very seriously. Now, if you find those three points, who we are as a species, what it is to respect each other, and the empirical evidence compelling, then we're left with the question, okay, what does this actually mean? What is this human right against social deprivation in its essence? And my answer there is, it depends. So the easiest case is that of babies and children. There we can make a compelling case that they have fundamental interests not only in access to decent social contact, but in sustained, persistent, caring, intimate relationships. To develop as a human being, to learn to speak, to learn to walk upright, even to learn to swallow, that depends on having someone associate very closely with you for a long time. Children have a right to what Joel Feinberg calls an open future, or at least a very broad set of options for their future. And that set of options can be compromised if they lack adequate social connections. The second group, where, again, the case is fairly easy to make, is that for other people who are abjectly dependent. So when we become elderly, or if we endure a period of acute incapacitation, there, our abject dependency gives us a strong claim to have not just access to decent social contact, but strong social connections. The toughest case is for those of us who are not abjectly dependent. And when I present this work and talk to people about this work, the thought seems to be, are you saying we all have to be friends with each other? And no, I'm not saying that. When we're not abjectly dependent, the strongest right I think we can assert is a right to have meaningful opportunities to cultivate decent social connections, and a right not to be rendered abjectly dependent. And we also, when we're not generally abjectly dependent, we do still experience some significant moments in our lives that make us momentarily abjectly dependent. So the great unknowns of life, giving birth, facing death, losing a loved one, these are all situations in which we have a strong interest in not facing them alone. And so there, our opportunities for decent social connection begin to turn into positive rights to contact. Now, I want to consider the implications of recognizing a right against social deprivation. The implications, first of all, for other human rights, second, for our institutions, and third, for us individually as people trying to struggle to live morally. Now, first, with respect to other human rights, if the story I've told about the human right against social deprivation is plausible, is correct, then it seems that many other human rights depend on the protection of this right for their own protection. Because the human right against social deprivation, if it's not secure, then the development and maintenance of our cognitive and physical function is compromised, comes under threat. And so those human rights that depend on good cognitive and physical function, like the right to vote, the right to participate in the democratic process, they depend on this social right to have been protected in the background. The same is true for our rights to brute subsistence and survival. So the right to access food, the right to make use of health care, the right to acquire education, they all depend on cognitive and physical function, which, again, has the protection of social connections in the background. The rights against cruel, degrading, and inhuman treatment. So someone who's coercively socially deprived is, I would argue, being treated in a way that is cruel, degrading, and inhuman. And that treatment also renders that person vulnerable to other types of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. So we have human rights against those things, and we need the protection of this social right in the background to make sure they're secure. We can then look at things that go beyond the basics of human rights. You know, human rights are about the brute moral minimum. Where does the buck stop in terms of how we treat each other? When we look more richly at human flourishing, then there are a lot of other things that this right supports, like autonomous choice, like equality of opportunity in society. How good is your chance of getting that job? Or, you know, how strong is the protection for your family's interests? And then there's also engagement with value, our capacity to have meaningful employment, to have self-respect, to be creative, to achieve things. All of this depends on good, secure physical and emotional function, which depends on the protection of our sociality. Okay, so it starts to look like the human right against social deprivation is, you know, really at the foundation. But if this one isn't protected, a lot of other things become are put at risk. And so one thing I'm tempted to argue is that this right cannot be conditional on good behavior. And that's contentious because in the context of punishment, criminal justice, there is a thought that for the most heinous of crimes, only the most serious punishments could be appropriate. And that, you know, that some types of acts seem so egregious, so abhorrent, that solitary confinement is the only option. Now, the difficulty there is that someone, to warrant solitary confinement, someone would have to have acted so badly that they not only forfeited their right against social deprivation, they forfeited all the other rights that stand above it, that depend on its protection. And given that solitary confinement can have a lasting, if not permanent, negative effect on your mind and your ability to lead a social life, you would have to forfeit permanently not only your right against social deprivation, but all of those other rights that depend on its protection. Now, you might think there are some types of behavior that are so very bad that you know, that does happen, but that starts to look pretty rare, that we are declaring someone beyond the pale, outside the human community, when we say that's the justifiable response. Now, I do want to grant that providing social connections to some people will be very difficult. Some people are, for lack of a better term, genuinely intolerable. You know, people who are highly contagious, people who are highly dangerous. And there, you know, we can either bite the bullet and say there will be some inevitable rights infringements. You know, there'll be some people's rights we cannot fully honor. Or we can try to explore other ways to honor those rights as best we can. So thinking about indirect contact, mediated contact, virtual contact, non-human contact. To what extent could socially assistive technologies provide a morally acceptable substitute when it would be really burdensome to ask someone to provide social connections? Now, I will leave that sort of unfinished because it's a tricky area, and especially, you know, the psychological experience of thinking you're getting social contact, that might seem satisfying, but if it's a robot or a virtual environment, you are not actually offering your care and company. So that the question, the idea I offered earlier about social contribution, we want to contribute, that would go unsatisfied if you're engaging only within a virtual environment or a surrogate. So what does this mean for us individually? What does this mean for our associative freedom? In Western societies, we're very protective of our freedom to choose the people we associate with. And we're pretty complacent about that freedom. John Stuart Mill said, we have the right to choose the society that is most acceptable to us. Now, that's patently false, because the society that's most acceptable to us might not think we're the most acceptable society. So, in many cases, your freedom to associate is constrained by consent. You know, the person that you want to associate with, do they want to associate with you? However, that's not always true, and you'll know where I'm about to go. In the cases of necessity and of harm, consent is not the most salient factor. It doesn't make sense to talk about associative freedom for babies or children. But it does make sense to talk about acute associative need. So their necessity and harm come into the picture. And indeed, they trump associative freedom, because we all needed someone to associate with us when we were babies and children. That had to take priority over others' right to refuse association. Otherwise, we couldn't even exercise associative choice later. So what we get when we think about associative freedom is, it's a question in philosophy that goes back to Immanuel Kant. What if everybody did that? What if everybody refused to associate with this child? What if everybody refused to visit or take part in the life of this elderly person? If we think that's if we're troubled by the idea that people's social needs would go unmet in those cases, then we are willing to say associative freedom is not nearly as expansive as we tend to presume it is in liberal thinking. And so I think where we end up with, what we end up with is the thought that it's permissible for you to refuse to associate when your associative services are not required. And it's permissible for you to refuse to associate when no one has special claims on you that you associate with them. And so that already will bring down associative freedom quite radically. Okay, so I'll sum up. Being social is a fundamental part of being a human being. It's a fundamentally valuable part of being a human being. Returning to Aristotle, who I quoted at the beginning, all the other goods in the world can't make up for the lack of social connections. And in many of those other goods depend on social connections for us to experience them. We have a human right against social deprivation, and both this right and other social rights need to be brought to the forefront of our thinking about human rights. Thank you.
So, questions?
Thank you for the question. In principle, I agree. I would want to maintain a certain flexibility and strategy. And because the unspoken worry is, where does social cohesion stop and homogeneity or even the totalitarian dictatorship start to pick up? When do we lose, all those dearly bought, dearly earned liberal protections that we champion? So I would probably want to pursue strategies that focus first on government's own actions in how they treat the people under their control. And so the discussion of institutions at the beginning, that would be the place to start. How are people being treated in prison? How are they being treated in hospitals? How are they being treated in immigration centers? And then, more broadly, I would want, not necessarily state-driven, some of it would be state-driven, but it could also be community-driven and more informal, a reflection on the way our structures, our practices, our attitudes either provide opportunities for incidental and deliberate social connection or shut those down. So, and there'll be points of contact between these two things. So where is the hospital built? How far is it from the town in which the user population lives? Where is the prison built? Those kinds of things make it more or less difficult to maintain connections. And in terms of us individually, I think there's something very useful in terms of personal morality to think that attending to each other's social needs is something that we should give more attention to. Matthew Liao is working on the idea that children have a right to be loved. And he argues that it's not just, children have a right to be loved by their carers, by their parents. He actually says we all have a duty to love children. And this is a wonderful idea. It doesn't necessarily mean we should be, interfering with the mother when she's trying to take care of the baby on the train, but that we should, be kind to children, smile at children, give them some preference in our thinking. That's a good place to start, in addition to thinking about more top-down approaches.
Can you tell us your
So how he came to be a political prisoner, or how his story. So if I know his story correctly, he was not intending to enter Iran, but was out hiking and drifted across the border. Whether that's true, I don't know. But was picked up and was held in isolation. And you know, he said his experience there was in many ways worse than what he saw in California. In California, the prisoners are allowed to shout at each other. They had to whisper in secret to each other. But he also got phone time, not much, but he could make 15 minutes worth of phone calls in 2 months. The people in Pelican Bay couldn't make any phone calls, at least not the time he visited. They couldn't write letters, he could. He had a bed, he had a mattress, they had a piece of foam. He had a private space to go to the washroom. They had to use the toilet in full view of the guards. So, the article, if you want to follow up his story, it's in Mother Jones.
Came out in
background. No. If you want to say why you think that's relevant. Okay.
A few of my elderly friends have been the subject of social deprivation indirectly by the very lawyers that they offered up their money in the form of legal fees to manage their financial affairs. And because the individuals are frail and puny and non-lawyers themselves, it was easy to have their life savings also skimmed by the lawyers that they've chosen to pay the legal fees. And so that deprives them of social outings and transportation to get social, because often it requires money. Mm. So who's going to fight the very lawyers themselves when they are at the pinnacle of society? Who will take that fight on the behalf of the vulnerable, frail, just about to die individuals?
I think that this right isn't much discussed, partly because it tends to be people who are invisible who experience it. So, we're very, very proud, in our society that we are very rights conscious, that we're very tolerant, very attentive to people's fundamental interests, but there are still silent sub-communities, people in prison, people who are elderly, people who are politically impotent, people who have severe disabilities, people who have no public voice and comparatively little public power, that it tends to be those people who are most vulnerable to this right. And so I think your question, it emphasizes the importance of having certain structures in place, sort of an institutional framework that supports people who are most vulnerable. And I'm cautiously optimistic that there's the potential for that if we look at economic welfare rights as a model. The people who are in desperate poverty also tend to be a politically impotent and not necessarily silent, but certainly a marginalized group in society. And yet those rights are getting a lot of traction, a lot of discussion. So, and there is some growing modest recognition in the States, and sort of very interesting things are happening now in New York and in Ohio, where there's attention being given to solitary confinement, to social needs, to loneliness. Loneliness is becoming a topic of conversation amongst psychologists. It's not yet much of a topic of conversation amongst philosophers, but we also tend to lie behind, sort of the things happen in practice and then we think about them afterwards. But I think there's cautious reason to be optimistic that we can give more attention to the structural issues that do make the vulnerable people more likely to be isolated.
Thank you for your time today. I have a question about the human right against social deprivation, and in particular how it could apply to people with asylum seeker status, and specifically a person like Edward Snowden, who has had to abandon his community and his the safety of his immediate environment for clients unknown. Yeah. So would that apply to somebody like him as well?
I think Edward Snowden, in a way, is lucky. Highly publicized case, a lot of attention to his interests. I'm sure he would prefer not to be where he is, but that his experience is quite different from many, many immigrants who don't necessarily speak the language, have no sense of what's expected legally and what's available to them, and can sort of fit into that category of incidental social deprivation. It's easy to give the same kind of response. We have to attend to structural issues and where we put our focus, but at some point we will run out of resources. So, and it's only if the case I've made about the very fundamental nature of our need for social connections is only if that's taken seriously that then this kind of issue would take precedence over other issues that have received more attention and more funding. The Red Cross does a lot of is attentive to this issue. So, for many asylum seekers, the Red Cross will provide some kind of just social connection, helping someone in their apartment find a local grocery store. So there's a sort of work on the ground. And I think actually a lot of faith-based work, the sort of a view of being welcoming to visitors, that is a valuable part. It doesn't all have to come down from the top or where the money comes from. But I think there's a lot more scope to be attentive to.
Could I? The visibility of the issue, they're often the social connection margin and where they want to do socially is left open by the tribunal member. And I'd like your thoughts about how we can. And I find often that disability workers, there are those in the front line workers in the accommodation place often forget about that right. So I'm wondering what your thoughts would be about trying to publicise that in human rights, or just generally out there to the front line staff.
Well, it is a problem, and in healthcare, when budgets are cut, the first things that tend to go are the regular visits to people in their homes. That kind of care is sort of viewed as, that's the luxury. Let's just focus on the basics. When that kind of care is often preventative, that's supportive. It helps someone keep going a little longer. In terms of good advice to the front line, I think when I presented this work, the material that seems to be most compelling is the empirical data. So just the reality of what happens when we're isolated, that it's not just children, it's not just people who are somehow particularly dependent on social connections, that we all have fundamental social needs. So the work of John Cacioppo, his book Loneliness, is very powerful in terms of showing just the realities of the situation. The work of Pamela Quartel, who's focused on adolescence, that also emphasizes that at particular times in our life, not just when we're abjectly dependent, but as we're growing up, that when we're teenagers, that's a time when we need to be very attentive to social needs. So I found that that tends to be what is most striking with the empirical data.
In terms of
all
that methods of social connection, yes, and maybe using technology as an alternative. I was just wondering about a comparison between having that face-to-face contact versus through technology, and do you think we lose having
And this is a place where I really struggle, because there's human rights are a potent tool because we keep them limited. So they're about the basics, the brute minimum, and so you're left feeling like what you're defending is so inadequate. It's so far below what we would want our social relations to be. And because, you know, the intimacy of touch is a very important part of our sociality. And having persistent, sustained, intimate associations where we share a story, we engage in shared activities, we know each other, we're witness to each other's lives, that's also really central to our sociality. And yet, you know, I'm reluctant to say that, you know, those are the ideals of human flourishing. That's the good life. Human rights are just about what do we need to get by. But I think going for that low minimum, that is the only way to have this be politically feasible. It's also the only way to hang tight to this potent tool, which we don't then apply to too many concepts. So there's a worry of rights proliferation or rights exhaustion. That this term's being used. I have a right to this, I have a right to that, and suddenly there's no substance to it. So all that for background, I think there's some place for thinking about socially assistive technologies. But I would not want to advocate that sort of in place of the possibility of direct human contact. So, I've talked to people who work in criminology and people like Sharon Shalev, who's wrote the source book on solitary confinement. Her worry is that if we talk about the use of social assistive technologies, then that will be what's used. There'll be, just as we have automated checkout counters, and actually one place to reintroduce some social connection for many people is to get rid of the automated checkout counters in the grocery store. But just as we would have those, we'd have the robot, we'd have the virtual environment, and we'd think, okay, we've done our job, we don't have to worry about people's social needs. So I want to explore technologies, but certainly not at the expense of direct human contact where it's possible and still within this narrow framework of the minimum for human rights.
Okay. I was just going to ask just to continue on with that question, I'll be very short. What about the role of pets in situations like that? So that seems to answer a lot of the concerns that draws away from others. Do you think that's an adequate solution or more of a band-aid?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. When I think about social contribution and justice, someone being denied opportunities to make a social contribution, we can ask, well, does it have to be specifically to other people that you're making that contribution, or could it be that you're taking care of the interests of animals? I'm friendly to the idea of animal rights. I think we shouldn't be overly speciesist about who counts and who we can care for and who we can love and show compassion for. So. My worry about denying someone human contact in terms of the social contribution injustice doesn't necessarily apply if we're talking about animals. And that's a question for psychologists, whether the experience of the person who has an animal surrogate would be comparable in the relevant ways to someone who had minimally adequate human contact. And then there's the question, okay, even if their experience is comparable, is that all we need to care about? I don't know if you're familiar with Robert Nozick's experience machine. He says, suppose you had the option of going into the Matrix, or you're going into a world of your own devising, and once you're in there, you don't know that you're in that experience machine, and so you're having whatever experiences you wanted to have going through your mind. He says most of us would not go into it because we want our decisions to be real. We want to have an impact on the world. We want to we want to do things. We want to realize genuine value, not just think we are. So there, I think we have to look beyond just the experience. And at that point, my reasoning becomes a bit fuzzy because I'm not quite sure. Because if you don't know, then what is it that we're grasping for? But I think we do have an intuition that just the experience isn't enough. Exactly.
Thanks for your presentation. It's easy to agree that most groups of people, for example, like the elderly and children, have a right to social connection, but I was wondering if you think there's any circumstances at all where by performing certain acts you're forfeiting the right to social contact, or
yeah.
Or rape, or...
Yeah, so the line of thought I was moving toward was no, that unless we think you are no longer a human being, you know, that you are really outside the human community, you are not redeemable, there's no way in which we can seek to reestablish reciprocal relations, unless we think that about someone, then this right is not conditional on good behavior. You know, there are some people who would say that some people are just beyond, you know, outside. What they've done is outside a human act.
Do you think that if...
Okay. So the opportunities we're providing are from other people in a similar situation. So then there'd be a question of, is this a brutal environment? If it's not, then that's interesting, because we then, you know, the question that comes back up is how much associative control matters. And while I've suggested that we can radically truncate associative freedom, if you have no control over your social contact, if it's this person and only this person, have we really met your need? So what's interesting is people who've endured solitary confinement, the anecdotal evidence is that they will say any companion, no matter how horrific, is better than no companion. So Sotko was wrong when he said hell is certain other people who will torture you. Hell is actually not having any other people.
I just wanted to ask how a legal framework that's saying about social contact with the other, and the other has need social contact.
I know. You might think that in practice, you know, we really want the society of the person who's there under duress, but I would say the person who has the social needs, that takes priority. You might look at, you know, how you make that work. You know, your person who's there under duress is not going to be cooperative. They're not going to do what they're wanting in terms of some kind of emotional connection or generosity of spirit toward the other person. So there, yeah, I don't know how much of a radical change in ethos we need, you know, to have a recognition that, you know, abject dependency takes priority over associative freedom, but that may be what's required. This is a hope of a change of heart, change of mind. The person who, you know, is being asked to provide their society will realize that there's good reason to accept this limitation of their rights. But I agree, it's the reason I do philosophy, because it starts to get really messy in practice. Yeah, so Ancient Greece is quite interesting, because they had a practice where the members of the assembly would hold a vote annually on whether to exile someone. And if they agreed, yes, this year we need to exile someone, then they would hold a second vote where they each got to write down the name of the person they wanted to exile, and whoever got the most votes was then exiled from Athens for up to 10 years, and they wrote that name on a broken piece of pottery called an ostracon, and that's where we get the word ostracism from. And what's interesting about that is that this wasn't a punishment, so there was no trial, there was no defense, it was just, this is what we need to do to neutralize political tensions. And so the person who was exiled, you know, there's sort of a question mark over that kind of treatment of someone. You know, if they're really lucky, they can go to another society that will accept them and take care of them and so on. But they also might be just as badly off as someone who's contained, confined, and isolated. And so, you know, that kind of treatment is comparatively rare now as a punishment. But there was a case in Canada in 2010 in Saskatchewan, a man who had been harassing a woman for over 3 decades. Part of his punishment was that he was exiled from Regina to Saskatoon for a year, and his lawyer argued that, you know, he's been, you know, his contact with his family suffered, his, you know, all of his social connections at home, you know, he'd been lost. And granted, you know, this is a year, not 10 years, but you know, family and sociality is really important. But the judge said there are lots of places for him to go, and you know, hopefully someone will accept him. So your more general question of whether we're more willing to socially deprive or less willing now. I don't have a good general answer for that. I'll go do some more looking. But they were willing to do it in ancient Greece.
Isolation is a form of punishment, but I know within the justice system it's often used to protect the person.
Right. Sorry, you actually asked, not quite what I expected. I expected you to say that it's also used like pre-trial. People are held in isolation to protect them, to protect other people, and not as a punishment, and then also after the fact as to incapacitate or protect. And there I think the treatment would be analogous to medical quarantine. So the case that, in the U.S. that most people know about is Typhoid Mary. Mary Malone, she was an asymptomatic carrier of typhoid fever. So she initially didn't know she had, was carrying the pathogen for typhoid fever, and she infected over 51 people, three of whom died. And as a result, spent 23 years in isolation and died in isolation and died of a stroke. So when someone has to be incapacitated or isolated for the sake of other people or even for their own sake, there I think the onus is on us to do as much as possible to mitigate the effects of it. And the studies in healthcare suggest that that's not what happens. What tends to happen is these people are cared for less well, that you're much more likely to experience bed sores or the types of care-related problems with falls and injuries that can go when you're being neglected and well cared for. So I think we need to sort of ramp it up a notch when someone has to be isolated to ensure that they're as well off as they can be. Yeah, so there, I think my thinking about that type of person, I don't see their situation as being different from someone in medical quarantine. That if it's for their sake or for other people's sake, we have to do the best we can to make sure that they're as well off as possible.
So I do have, before we finish up, I have an announcement to make about another Passion Centre event next week. A week from today, on Wednesday the 23rd of April, Professor Gavin Phillipson from the University of Durham will be speaking on hate speech laws, what they should and shouldn't try to do. And as I'm sure all or most of you would know, that's a very topical issue at the moment in Australia, as there are a draft exposure bill under discussion put forward by our Attorney General, the Andrew Bolt amendments. So we'll welcome all of you back for that event next week if you're able to come. In the meantime, Jeremy, thank you for your presentation.